Hello and welcome to this Undisclosed Addendum. This is Colin Miller, one of the co-hosts of the Undisclosed Podcast. As always, I am joined by my co-host, Rabia Chowdhury. Rabia, how's it going?
I'm well. How are you?
Doing great. Looking forward to the 4th of July weekend.
Yeah.
We're also joined, as always this season, by Jennifer Leahy, a research and investigative assistant. She's been working various cases with Rabia going back to the Jason Carroll case in New Hampshire. So Jen, how's it going?
Really well, Colin. Thanks.
Great. Well, we'll be discussing all things Episode 6, Target Acquired, in the Patricia Rohr series. But before that, I wanted to touch upon a case in the news. And Rabia, you and I were just discussing in the Patreon episode, case out of Oregon, in which a man was exonerated based upon bite mark evidence. And then just 2 days ago, Supreme Court of Louisiana upholds a lower court finding that releases Jimmy Chris Duncan from death row in Louisiana. Mr. Duncan had been convicted based upon the killing of his former girlfriend's toddler. And Rabia, at the heart of the evidence against him was bite mark testimony claiming bite marks on the victim was a match for an exemplar of Mr. Duncan's teeth. And we have essentially the Supreme Court of Louisiana agreeing with the lower court. Bite mark evidence is junk science. It should play no role in a criminal courtroom. And what I wonder, Rabia, we'll get to the hair evidence in this case going forward. In fact, starting next episode, but we've had around 40 exonerations based upon flawed bite mark analysis.
Well,
hair comparison was also the target of the President's Counsel report in 2016. Finding that comparison was maybe even more flawed the way the FBI did it for the years covering
The FBI themselves were like, oops, they put out an entire memo that this whole science is flawed.
So I have my own take. Rabia, what's your thought about why all of these bite mark defendants are getting relief and yet none of these hair defendants really are getting relief?
I mean, it's hard to know exactly. I mean, I think it's a case by case type of thing. My guess is that bite mark analysis was given more probative value, more forensic value in a court of law, where maybe in a lot of these cases with the hair comparison, that there were other, you know, I can see a judge saying that, well, it wouldn't have outweighed the other factors, you know, that led the jury to believe this person's guilty. But I don't know. That's a wild guess. What do you think?
My take is that there is a way to do a hair comparison that's valid. Now, it requires the root, it requires a trained expert, but there's not a proven way to do a bite mark comparison. I think that the courts
is that
are
right?
more...
Because if there's a root, don't you just take that straight to like DNA
analysis?
You can
just do DNA in addition to the comparison.
Yeah.
And that sort of seals the deal. Yeah.
But a lot of these cases, like the one we're looking at right now, you know, this is early days of DNA, and I'm sure there's cases that were well before there was any kind of DNA testing. Are straight up like human compare. Are you saying in the absence of DNA testing or any kind of like, you know, that kind of, or blood on the hair or something, like there's
Correct.
Still like a valid way to compare
no,
hair?
No, no.
Right.
You need the blood or the root with the DNA. There's not a visual way to make that comparison.
Okay. Interesting. I don't know why we aren't seeing that more and more. Maybe it wasn't used as much. I don't know. I don't know. But I'm also not keeping track like you, though, Colin.
Yeah. Jen, what's your take, you know, having worked on this case, about why courts are so reluctant to look at faulty hair analysis and grant relief?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, I don't know that I can go right now into like some of the specifics of this case, right? Because we're going to get into that in future
we'll
episodes. But I share your like, you answered the question I was going to ask you about your take on the hair, which was like, have you seen evidence that like visuals alone, right, are enough? And you said, no, they're not. Because I was wondering it, like looking at some of the hair stuff that we'll get into, like how, you know, is there a way to visually compare hair when hair can change over time and hair can vary even, you know, like chemically, hair can, hair, you know, like even two hairs on the same person's head. Like, I've seen notes that like they look different. So like, how, like, are there standards? And it sounds like you're saying, as far as you know, no, like it, there has to be something more than just a visual comparison. Why that's not being used?
Well, I have one more theory that just occurred to me, and that is this: it could be that in the course of these trials that there were challenges raised to the hair comparison, you know, and so the defendant was given the opportunity in a way that was more meaningful. Whereas I feel like bite mark analysis, I can totally see it coming across as much more of an exact science, right? You know, if you have like somebody's, you know, if you have a bite mark and you kind of do a, and you know, we all grew up knowing that everybody's like dental records are different and the teeth are different. You identify people with it. So there's a much more exact science with dental work and teeth.
And there's a language that's used too, Rabia, to your point, which is with hair, it's, we can't exclude the defendant as the source of hair, but with bite mark, it was the forensic dentist coming in and saying, I can affirmatively say this is the defendant's bite mark on the victim.
Yeah. There's lots of different things.
Yeah. And so that sort of previews what we'll start discussing in episode 7, but I want to start by linking episode 6, Target Acquired, with episode 5. And that's because, Rabia, as we noted in this episode, back in the day, there was an FBI profile done of the killer in this case by Stephen Etter. And of course, last episode, we had Dr. Reed doing her own profile. And so I'm curious for both of you, I'll start with you, Rabia. What's your take in terms of comparing and contrasting these two profiles? And what does that tell you about this case?
Okay, so here's the problem with the 1995 FBI profile that we are told exists.
Right, we don't have the actual
profile. We don't have it. Yeah. And what we have is a secondhand account of one of the agents who read it and gave us whatever he remembered many, many, many years later. I mean, I think it was like, I don't even know. It was a long time later. And the reason the information he gave in that, I think was after the fact, as after the conviction, and it was kind of really limited. So this FBI agent was like, oh yeah, I mean, the profile said X, Y, but it didn't say whether or not it would be a male or more likely a male or female, which I find hard to believe that that wouldn't be something that a profiler would try to, you know, have an opinion about at least. So I feel like it's, the information he gave is really limited. The second thing is this, and we're going to talk about this actually, in the addendum for episode 7, I think. And that is that there are other things in that FBI agent's report when he was interviewed many years later, that he got wrong, that I know he got wrong, factually got wrong about, just not things that were evident, like really important, but kind of narratively important. You know what I mean? So I have to take it with a grain of salt, but I'll say this, you know, both of these profiles did say that it's likely somebody that, you know, Joanne knew, that she, you know, that it was probably a surprise that this person knew the home well, and they knew the place that they disposed of the bodies well. And the problem is that those things kind of apply both to Andy and Patty, except that Patty and Joe did not really know each other. They had never met before. So there's that's a big distinction there.
Right. Jim, what's your own take in hearing the secondhand profile by Stephen Etter and then this newer profile that Rabia did with Dr. Reed?
Yeah, I mean, I so wish we had access to the other file, like Rabia was saying. I actually was telling her I just got a FOIA request back.
Is it in there?
I haven't uploaded it yet, but I did look through it. I'm going to look through it in more detail, but it really looks like all the stuff we've already had. Like, I'll go through it again just to make sure, like, there's not something in the PDF, but nothing's jumped out at me as like, oh, I have not seen this before.
You know? I don't think it's a mistake that that the file is missing it. I just don't think. I always think these things, there's a reason we have some documents, a reason that the defense never got some documents.
I mean, the polygraph is also missing, which I know is, a polygraph is not admissible, whatever. It's not really, you know, it's maybe a tool, but not, but like, there are some things that are, there's some info requests.
It just feels weird. Why wouldn't the FBI have that? Of course the FBI should have a copy of that polygraph. Where the heck is it?
Right. All right. And from the profile, then getting into the heart of episode six, you know, Rabia, we've talked for years about bombshells in different cases. And I think from the listener reaction, we can fairly characterize this as a bombshell. And that is Walter Trautman. And he says, around 1 p.m., I see a man banging on this car saying, "What do you mean it's not my kid?" He reports this first on the day of the incident, and he later identifies the person in the car as Joe and the man banging as Andy. Where I want to start with this is going back to Sandra Fulper, right? Sandra Fulper was the neighbor who said, "I was doing laundry and I saw Joe putting Alex into the car about 12:30 p.m. And yes, she misidentified the clothes. Yes, it wasn't reported until later, but if that's true, that's around 12:30. That timeline would work really well with Walter Trautman's report. And so, Jen, taking you back to Sandra Fulper, does this in your mind revive her statement at all? Or do you still think she had the wrong day or time?
Yeah, no, I think it's definitely worth looking into. And I mean, whether or not she misidentified the clothes, like maybe she didn't. Maybe somehow they were changed. You know, like we don't know. Like it's at this point, we don't know for sure. What puzzles me about Trautman is like whether or not he saw them, like how is this, how do you just throw out a statement? Like, how do you admit, like on the record, I tossed it out. Like I threw it right in the garbage. Like that's just, I mean, I'm a lay person. I've never worked in law enforcement, you know, but it seems, I was shocked when I read that, like that could just be tossed out. And especially because his initial statement, his initial reaching out to police seems to have happened right on that day, you know, so it wasn't like he saw them on the news later, you know, and was like, oh, this reminds me of that thing I saw. Like he had flagged it in his mind as something of concern, like right in that moment.
Yeah, and Jen, let me ask this, and I'll follow up with Rabia as well. People have different schedules and different ways they do chores. Growing up in my household and as an adult, I had particular days of the week we did laundry, or I did laundry in particular times, especially if I was living in shared living, an apartment, et cetera. And so, I mean, Jen, was that your experience as well? Or, I mean, I'm trying to figure out, you know, would Fulper kind of know, oh, Thursday is a day I typically did laundry early afternoon, or, you know, what's your take on whether she could be mistaking or conflating different days or times?
Yeah, I can totally see if that day was always laundry day. It would have been nice to like hear her say that out, you know, mm-hmm. like this is how I know. And it would have been nice. It's confusing because from what I can tell, her initial statement does not mention that at all. Right. You know, it's only later, but I mean, memories are fallible. That was not my experience growing up, but I know lots of people that did have a more regimented schedule.
Yeah, I was going to say like every day is laundry day in most of my adult life. Right, right. And then exactly. when you have an infant in the house, you know, I you never know. I mean, like you could be like, okay, we just went through the fourth jumper today because of vomiting or diarrhea or whatever. My issue with the Fulper statement is that it makes absolutely zero sense that the first time she's interviewed, she never mentions this. In mm-hmm. fact, she never mentions this until the authorities bring it up themselves. And the first time she's interviewed, I think, is literally the day after Joe disappears. It feels like too big of an omission. Uh-huh. It just doesn't. It doesn't sit well with me that she's telling other people this and she doesn't tell the police this. And that's why I question the veracity of her statement. But then when we're talking about Trautman, we also have to think about, okay, was Joe on the phone with her mother-in-law then around 1:15 to 1:30? Or was she fighting with Andy somewhere and Trautman saw this? Right. We have another conflict, a timing conflict here with the different witnesses.
Yeah, and Rabia, in terms of what the defense was or wasn't able to do back at the time of trial with this information, you noted in the episode, in the notes, Egan writes down Trautman, not Trautman. And that actually is significant, right? According to Patricia's team on appeal, because they weren't able to figure out at the time of trial, right, who this person was.
Well, it's significant for a lot of reasons. I mean, everything about this whole issue with Trautman, whether or not he's right about what he saw or who he saw, right? The problem is not only did Egan throw out that letter of his own admission, there is zero documentation of all these visits. that he says that Trotman made. Trotman's like, I was there like four times. Trotman's like, once I talked to this person, they took down notes. Once I talked to this person. None of that exists, by the way. And Trotman started showing up at the police station, the barracks, right after he saw Andy in the news, in a newspaper coming out of the funeral. So it would have been like, I don't know, sometime in late April or May of that year. The first time you have a written report of Trotman and all this is when the one whatever altercation took place between them was like, I think it was like October. It was many, many months later. And that's when Egan's like, oh my God, he's been here 15 times. He's harassing us. Where's all the documentation? Why don't we know exactly what days he's been there and what he has said? Where are all the reports this man made? It's not just that one letter. We don't know. This is the only documentation right. we have. And so, and the other thing we have to do is the problem is, you know, after that Trotman, you know, he gave depositions, he gave sworn testimony. Like, he kept showing up over and over again to say, this is what I saw. And what the state was able to do, or at least what the response of the police at the time was like, well, every time he came, he had a different story, but we don't know that because
right.
we don't have proof of what you wrote down. So they dismissed him. They're telling us they dismissed him because of all of these things. They could be completely lying. And Trotman, even years later, I mean, he passed away, unfortunately, but years later was like, I never said all these different things that he was in a wig and now he had this. Right. And, you know, so they were undermining what they're saying he was saying, but I don't believe them because you don't have any proof. And even that phone call he made on the day he saw this, December 15th, 1994, right. where is a recording, a transcript of that? Nobody. Like if the state, if Egan actually investigated this, like if, because he says, I looked into it. Where's the evidence of that? Right. That would be the first thing you should do is get a copy of that report, right? Either the phone call, a recording of the phone call to the dispatcher or a transcript of it. It doesn't exist. I don't. And because he went on to misidentify Trotman in that one single report, even his age, he got his age wrong. Like he wrote everything about him wrong. Later for the defense to find him was almost impossible. Right. So, yeah.
And there's the drawing. I mean, why would he destroy the drawing unless it looked like Andy, right? If it looks right. like, if it has someone with a weird wig or it looks right. like a Hispanic individual, you would keep that and show, look, here's the reason why I disregarded this, right?
Exactly, yeah. And the thing is, like, you know, this is around the same, this is all coalescing around the same time that they're like, their attention is turning towards Patty. And mm-hmm. so we've examined this phenomenon before where, you know, investigators will ignore what they call bad evidence because right. it hurts their case. And that's what was happening here.
And Robbie, to the point you just raised about what happened December 15th, we just discussed Sandra Fulper. And to your point, in full fairness, Sandra Fulper should be taken with a grain of salt because she did not initially report this. The polar opposite in this case is Walter Trotman because he's sure. the only one in this case who makes a report before anyone knows anything has gone awry with Joe, right? Mother-in-law and even Patty herself, everyone knows, okay, something's gone wrong. But when he first comes forward with his information, he has no reason to know anything that happened. He just knows that he saw what he saw, right?
Yeah, he doesn't even know who these people are.
Right.
Until like many months later. And then... And then there's another witness that yeah. I did not squeeze into the episode. But
and let me add, before I get to this, because I found this really important, let me just ask Robbie, in terms of making decisions about the cutting room floor, why did you not include this second statement that I'll read in a second?
You know, here's the thing. I think this is important. I do think it's important. I think people are following along in the addendum, but I also think that there can be listener fatigue mm-hmm. when you are throwing names and you know, you know, what's the difference between, okay, the Trotman story is problematic to me, not just because whatever investigative value Trotman would have had to say actually had, but because of how the police treated what he mm-hmm. had to say and treated him. And I wanted to lay that out to kind of show that the police were so honed in at this point, their target was acquired, that's how they treated that. You're right. Maybe I should have put this in, but I was like, how many names and dates and people, like, do I throw at people? Although our listeners can handle it. So I don't know. It was, it was a, it, it was a, It was a decision, but maybe not the best made one. But I think this is important, so pay attention, folks.
All right, so let me just read this. This is a homicide investigation action report. The interview is conducted on April 18th, 1995. It says, this is referring to an interview with Ms. Maureen Ann McKenna. Ms. McKenna contacted Troop M. Bethlehem and related, after viewing a television newscast of the Katrinak's funeral, she realized on the date of the disappearance of Joanne Katrinak and Alex Katrinak, she observed a man who she recognized from the television segment of the funeral as Andy Katrinak, arguing with a woman whom she recognized as Joanne Katrinak on Broad Street in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, about 1400 hours, 2 p.m. She related Mr. Andy Katrinak was holding a baby yelling at Mrs. Joanne Katrinak. The argument was over the child. McKenna advised the man who she believes to be Andy Katrinak was driving a black four-door car and the woman was driving a light blue smaller model vehicle. This trooper is aware that Mr. Andy Katrinak can account for his whereabouts on December 15, 94 and could not have been in Bethlehem. The vehicle described by McKenna cannot be associated with the Katrinaks and McKenna's recollection is based on viewing the Katrinaks on television.
Yeah.
So I'll start with you, Rabia. What is your take on this action report and McKenna?
All right. So what we have here is a report made very shortly after the bodies of the victims are found by a woman who had never come before, who did not show up in this in the police investigation before. And again, she's like, I saw news footage of the funeral. And she's like, holy crap, those are the people I saw arguing over a baby. Now, here's the thing. She's reporting this in April of 95, you know, towards the end of April of 95, about an incident that she says she saw in December. The one thing she's not able to do, at least from what we know here, is that the report, at least, is that we don't know what date she saw it. There's no date. Okay. She said it was around 2 p.m. the afternoon, whenever it was she saw it. It sounds very much like what Trotman saw, but the location is different. That doesn't mean they couldn't have moved around, right? Andy and Joe could have been one place and then they moved somewhere else. It fits the same in the same general time as Trotman saw something. We just don't know the timing. We just don't know the date that this happened. And then the significant difference is that they saw completely different cars. Like, you know, right. She's like, I saw Andy had a black four door and the woman's driving a light blue smaller model vehicle. Those reports don't only that's not what Trotman reports at all. And also, they don't own cars like that, which is actually accurate. But, you know, you can tell us how quickly, I mean, like they're done with Andy. Andy is not a suspect. They're like, you know, Andy Katrinak can account for his whereabouts on 12/15/94 and could not been in Bethlehem. So they're not even, Andy's not in the mix, you know, and they have just found the bodies. I don't know. I'm confused about this whole thing.
Jen, let me ask you, because, you know, obviously on the podcast, we have discussed the questions about the paternity of Alex and whether, in fact, Alex is Andy's child. But when we look here at Walter Trotman, and then in this we have Maureen McKenna, they're both talking about arguments over a child, and specifically Walter Trotman is talking about the paternity of that child. And Jen, am I correct that, you know, neither of them from the reporting at the time would have any reason to know that there are questions about paternity?
Correct. Yeah, I don't believe that was at all shared, and certainly not when Trotman was making his initial reports. And I'd have to actually look. I'm not sure if it was ever shared publicly. I've seen it in the files, you know, conversations. But yeah, no, they wouldn't have known.
And what's your own take, Jen, on McKenna here? Is this, in your eyes, a reliable lead, or at least something that bears some degree of credence? Or do you think that this is someone who got it wrong?
Yeah, I mean, it's curious. I don't know if she got it wrong. I mean, she's like, I guess she saw what she thinks she saw, right? And she probably did see people arguing by a car, and it sounds like the cars don't match up. And I mean, honestly, I would not trust myself to be able to remember.
Right. Cause she's reporting something from months earlier.
And so maybe, you know, she's erring on the side of caution. Like like perhaps she should do. Police are always saying, if you think you see something, no matter how insignificant it might be, like let us decide that, right? You know? Yeah. And let us look into it.
Here's the thing. I'll say this once again. Okay, if the police wanted, if the police decided that Andy like is going to be our like main suspect here, like, and he has not been cleared, both of these two witnesses are the kind of witnesses you could put in a court of law. Mm-hmm. Okay. This is not hearsay evidence that they're presenting. They've been firsthand eyewitness testimony. They could make a case against Andy based just on these two witness statements, I think. You know what I mean? Like we will talk about how the state just zhuzhed over all the inconsistencies in their case against Patty soon, but they could have easily zhuzhed some of the inconsistencies here as well. It's just, it's so similar, but what it's showing us is that the police literally dropped the ball completely against Andy. They just didn't even attempt to eliminate him properly.
Yeah. All right. Last talking point that I have, and this is going to take us full circle to the start of the episode, mentioned that hair analysis can be done correctly. And in one case we covered where it was done correctly was Dennis Perry. He was, of course, convicted of the murder of the Swains in rural Georgia. And then years later, they got a hair sample from alternate suspect Eric Spar from his mother, and the mitochondrial DNA was a match. And so Spar is now facing retrial. But Rabia, a big issue and a big reason why Dennis Perry was wrongfully convicted was his case went cold. And then he was asked years later to try to retrace what his alibi was. Mm-hmm. And Robbie, the last talking point we have here is, as you know, the FBI waited so long to verify Patty's alibis. And that was a huge issue, right?
Yeah, some of them, not all of them. Mm-hmm. When Patty first spoke to the police back, it was, I think, December 22nd. So it was just like within that first week after they disappeared. She at that time, she already was like, oh, you know, I know I was doing this and this and this on that day. It's like the week after they disappeared. But, you know, Patty actually had a pretty a consistent schedule. You know, on Tuesdays and Wednesdays, she did certain things. On Thursdays, she did certain things. She had a pretty consistent, so that's how she knew that that's what happened. And she told the police, and the police actually did at the time go and try and follow up with a couple of people. Like, I think they followed up with the guy who perhaps had sold her grain, because we're going to talk about all these different alibis. But there were other things that they did not touch at all, including, but see, even the grain issue was that she said she bought grain the day before. The alibi she provided for the day of the disappearance, December 15th, they actually don't verify that at all. They do not verify those alibis at all. And much later, when they finally get around to it, I think it's like in the summer of that year when they finally get, like 6 months later when they finally get around to it, people's memories have changed. And, you know, Patty in the meantime, and this is held against her, in fact, later, Patty in the meantime keeps following up with these people. It's like, do you remember when I had that conversation with you?
Right.
You know, because she's like, if nobody else is verifying this, I got to verify this. And let this be a lesson to folks. You know what I mean? Get people, think of what I did with Asia McLean in all those years ago. Get people to write down what they remember as quickly as you can. And if you don't, if you can't be part of it, get a third party to get them to do it. If the police are not doing their job or defense counsel, somebody's got to do it. But yeah, it was a big issue, and she was very frustrated with him.
Yeah. All right, let's turn now to listener questions and thoughts. And so echoing what many listeners wrote on social media, we had Tanya Goth Simmons. Y'all, the gasp by gasp when I heard the Walter Trotman section of this week's episode. I may have screamed in my car, he effing did it. And so Jen, let me go ahead and start with you. With your work in the case, when you first learned about Walter Trotman and read the reports about him, what was your initial reaction to reading what he said?
Yeah. It had my mind turning. And I think eventually I came to be more along the lines of like what it says about where the police were at, where the advanced investigation was at, more than anything. Like, but it raises some questions for sure, you know? And especially I think the last digit of the license plate potentially matched the car, her car, right, Rabia?
That was a question I had as well. Is that's true, that the number he mentioned did match, Rabia?
It did match. I think it was like a six or something.
Yeah, but I mean, like, there's like a 1 in 10 chance of that. Or, you know, I mean, it's not necessarily, that's not.
I mean, look, if we had a transcript, if we had a, you know, maybe that's the thing, you could try to FOIA. Who knows, Jen? What if all these years later you're able to find a transcript for FOIA with the Allentown police of his initial call in the report? It might have had, you know, the details he would have given then would have been the details that I believe, right? Like, I don't know what to believe all those years later.
And Rabia, that was another question I had, which is that we mentioned in the episode that he talked to his girlfriend about what he saw. Has anyone been able to track down or speak with the girlfriends to understand what he might have told her contemporaneously?
I have not seen it anywhere in the investigative files. And that's an interesting question. I should ask Tammy Ma, who's Patricia's advocate, whether or not that was done. That would have been a good thing to do, but no.
I haven't seen it anyway.
We have her name.
Oh, we do? Okay.
We have her name.
I don't know if she's still alive, but you know, if she shared it with her kids at this point, that would be sort of like third hand. But
yeah.
And then, Jen, following up with the point you just made about how Andy was treated in the investigation, we had Shell Walker write, "Does Andy or his parents have any connection to local law enforcement? That trooper seemed overzealous in rejection of that eyewitness statement." And so, Jen, do we know about Andy's family and any ties to local law enforcement?
Yeah, so that is a question we've sort of been batting around, and I've heard asked elsewhere as well. So really, exactly, it's like, what's going on here? Why this treatment, why the treatment of Troutman, like, you know, in his statements. I haven't been able to find like anything super specific yet. I'm working on, you know, family trees and everything. It seems like families and communities, like in that community, go back, you know, a ways. Like, people are interconnected. Like, even Joanne, you know, like in her dating history, had dated at least two cops in the past, you know? So like, I would be surprised if they didn't know somebody in law enforcement somewhere. But, you know, and his, you know, like involvement, I know his dad was involved in like a bowling league, you know, or social clubs, that sort of thing. Like, I would almost need, like, I would need to crunch through a lot of, and I've been working on it, names. But I haven't found anything that like really jumps out, you know, is like, like this was his, like, you know, uncle or something. I mean, I know a lot of enforcement also, spent a lot of time with Andy, you know, and I wonder if they just like,
I mean, look, they polygraphed him over and over, right? And he failed him. But I think they just sort of like, how do we get around the fact that there's multiple witnesses, you know, all the way over in wherever he was. I can't remember the name of the town, but at the Holschwenders, including the Holschwenders themselves. And we will get into that as well. We're examining a little closer their statements.
So I read the DA's book, McIntyre.
Oh, that's right. I have not read it.
Yeah. Okay. And one thing, and now I can't quote directly, but one thing I noticed him mentioning in at least one place is that basically people, like the investigators, spent a lot of time talking with Andy, and I think they kind of liked him, you know, like, like, I think he kind of says it, because I remember I might have even highlighted it in the book. I got like the, you know, the Amazon like Kindle version or whatever. Yeah. And so that kind of made me think, like, even if he wasn't directly connected to Egan, you know, like, you're spending a lot of time with somebody and you like, you know, maybe they're guys, maybe similar ages, you know, maybe friendly, affable.
And we're going to talk about McIntyre later because he's a prosecutor, but he's a whole other character. His personal investment in this case is shocking. He did write a book. He has sued people. It's been crazy with this guy, but Andy in general is described as likable. Like, I haven't seen anybody describe Andy as somebody who like this, he's always described as easygoing, nice, quiet. His neighbors are like, seem like a nice guy. Everybody's like, seem like a nice guy. Right. You know, Joe's parents, her family, seem like a nice guy. I mean, like, so yeah, I can totally see them getting. And I also wonder, we're talking about 94 here. I mean, there was an era in which it felt like every time you turned around, there was another family annihilator case in the news. And that as a phenomena, like if that was something that people, the police kind of had their antennas up for at that time, I feel like maybe not.
Yeah. Well, and Rabia, you know, to this point about how Andy was treated versus how Patty was treated, we had a comment by Lindsay412. how did you choose the current case to investigate? And so I wonder, Rabia, when you took this case on, how much of this was about, I think Patty was wrongfully convicted versus I think Andy was let off too easily? Equal parts, or was one
You know, I think as a matter of how Undisclosed does business, we don't report on cases, investigate them, unless we think this is an actual innocence case, mm-hmm. for sure. And we're going to get into all the innocence factors with Patty as well. This is a case that came to us from the Georgetown Innocence Clinic, I think it's like their innocence clinic. It has been vetted. You know, we'll get into all the stuff that's been done since Patty's conviction as well. There's an organization called Judges for Justice. A lot of people who know, you know, when something goes wrong in the criminal justice system, who are experts on these issues, have looked at this case and said something's deeply wrong here. And so, you know, a lot of the vetting was done already. And then as I spent like maybe 6-7 months looking into the materials myself, and I said, yeah, I think she's actually innocent. And, you know, in any case, when somebody's actually innocent, that means the police let somebody off. They failed their jobs.
I'm going to turn now to two SpeakPipe messages from a listener, Gene, who I believe has a pathology or some other type of background. And so here's the first message by Gene.
Hi, if Joe carried a bottle of water in order to add formula, was there no reference to whatever container carried the dry powdered formula in the diaper bag and whether that was empty? And I'm thinking that the autopsy was wrong and the baby was suffocated.
Yeah, we can play the second message, which ties into the end of that message.
If you look at the pillowcase murders, which I am interviewed on, it's on Peacock. Many, many elderly women were suffocated with a pillow, and the medical examiner did not discover suffocation as the cause of death. They were all ruled natural causes. And do you have any information on whether there was a Christmas tree farm at the time in the area that could have been the ruse to take her out there? Thank you.
Jen, let me start with you. What is your take on the first part of that? Do we know about anything about a container for the dry baby formula in the crime scene?
Yeah, we sure do. There was a container found in the diaper bag. Robbie and I actually saw it when we were down in Allentown. We didn't open it up, but it did look nearly full. It had some like rust spots. It was one of those metal containers. So mm-hmm. I know somebody in our Facebook group had mentioned like, oh, it looks like there's blood on the container. And in person, it appears that that's like rust, you know, from moisture on the metal container over the, you know, the months that it was out there. But yes, so a container had nearly full, I would assume a container was found in the diaper bag.
Yeah. And if you, if you pay attention closely to the episode in which you can hear Jen and us going through the stuff, the evidence the court has, we talk about that. And the other thing is the container was completely full, except that it was unsealed. The seal was broken. So that means, and I know like nobody breaks the seal unless they're ready to use a formula. So I believe it was probably a new can that she had opened once, maybe used once or twice.
Got it. And then, Robbie, what's your thinking in terms of, again, I'm not sure about Jean's background, but she's certainly referencing this litany of cases where the MA did not discover suffocation as cause of death. Do you think there's any chance that Alex was suffocated and was misdiagnosed?
Yeah. I mean, like, the MA did not rule it out either. Mm-hmm. The MA is like, it's either exposure or it's suffocation. We just don't know which one it is.
Yeah.
So it's certainly possible. The suffocation also, but could have been inadvertent because of his position, right? It doesn't mean that somebody necessarily did like suffocated him on purpose. We just don't know. I think I tend to lean towards, given how Alex was positioned on his mom, that somebody just couldn't bring themselves to kill him themselves with their own hands. They left him there for fate, nature to take its course.
Then the last part, do we know in the record anywhere where Joe and Andy had gotten Christmas trees in prior years, or is that not anywhere in the record?
No, that's nowhere in the record. And again, look, the entire Christmas tree, he could have taken out to an empty parking lot, you know, like in the middle of a mall, right. And like, because she had no idea. Mm-hmm. You know, according to Andy himself, she didn't know the area. This is not like back in the day where I could have pulled out a cell phone and been like, where are right. we going? You know, like she would have had no idea. They're just going somewhere into the country. And this is rural Pennsylvania. There could be Christmas trees all over the place.
Well, I think that wraps up our coverage of episode 6. Rabia, we tease at the end of this episode, the murder for hire. What can listeners expect in episode 7?
In episode 7, well, we are going to get into kind of like how the police, when they start looking at Patty and they start taking her seriously as a suspect, which I mean, honestly, if you look at kind of like, you know, I'm sure when Andy first kept saying, oh, my girl, my ex-girlfriend, like got hung up on, the police were like, dude, she's like in North Carolina. I mean, yeah. they didn't take it seriously. Well, they first started taking her seriously and then they start digging down and talking to people she knew. And this entire narrative is being built against her. And I, so a lot of episode 7 is about kind of like the police are laying the foundation of, and trying to figure out who Patty is and is this something she's capable of? And then based on that, if they decide, yeah, she's capable of this, and then we get into how they actually build that case against her.
Got it. All right, Rabia, Jen, thanks so much. And listeners, we will see you back next Monday for episode 7 of The State vs. Patricia Rohr.
Thanks, Colin. Thanks, Jen.
Thanks, Colin. Thanks, Rabia.
Bye, guys. As we all know, there is always more to the story. And if you want even more undisclosed content, remember, you can become a patron by signing up at patreon.com/undisclosedpod. And if you've got feedback for us, you can find us at speakpipe.com/undisclosed, where you can leave us an actual voice note. Don't forget to subscribe to our YouTube channel at undisclosedpod. You can follow us on Instagram and Facebook at undisclosedpod. And we've got our own little private Facebook group called the Toward Justice Community. All you gotta do is answer 3 quick questions and I will let you in. You can follow me, Rabia, on Instagram at RabiaSquared2, the number 2. And you can follow Colin at EvidenceProf on X and Blue Sky. Follow the podcast on X at UndisclosedPod. We want to thank our sponsors, and I want to thank our intrepid team, our sound editor, Hannah McCarthy, our executive producer, Meethal Thelhan, and my amazing investigator, Jennifer Leahy. And a very special thank you to true crime author and advocate Tammy Mall, who made this season possible. Thank you, Tammy, for all your work.